Hi, I'm Moji Alawodeyau from the Feminist Buzzkills Live Pod, the only podcast that helps you navigate the news in this post-pro anti-abortion hellscape. Each week, with co-host Liz Winstead, we dissect all the news from that sketchy intersection of abortion and misogyny with providers and activists working on the ground. The cherry on top is we have amazing comedy guests who help us laugh through the rage. Feminist Buzzkills Live drops Fridays wherever you pod. Listen and subscribe, because when BS is popping, we pop off.
Our press secretary gave alternative facts to that.
My goal in this deposition was to be truthful, but not particularly helpful.
Welcome to Unspun, the podcast that makes you better at finding the truth. The way people get news is changing. It used to be that there were many reporters who would research stories and write articles, but now politicians and famous people share information directly with you on social media and the internet. That means you find out things fast, but it's up to you to make sure the information's actually accurate. And newsmakers don't always do their part. The temptation to manipulate information is strong. They bend the truth to deceive so that they can avoid accountability, so that they can advance their agendas. When you recognize these agendas, you can sometimes find out what's real. And we're at a crossroads where anyone can share anything online, so it's important to sharpen your critical thinking skills. Finding that deception before it goes viral is pretty much a survival skill now, and we're going to do it together. Let's get Unspun. Hello, truth seekers, and welcome to Unspun for this week. In today's episode, we're going to be looking at a rhetorical tactic that politicians will use sometimes to get ahead or to get out of trouble, and then we're going to learn about a messaging strategy that I think is responsible for a lot of the big divisions that we have right now. And social media even makes that worse. Before we get into it, I wanted to thank you all for listening over the last year. It's been so fun to see the audience for Unspun grow, and I really appreciate it when you've taken the time to write a review, send me an email, give a rating on a podcast app, or even just to forward the show notes from Substack to a friend so that they can listen to. You are the best truth seekers, and I really, really value you. I'm looking forward to a lot of quality time together in 2025. Okay, let's get Unspun. This may sound a little bit outrageous, but let me tell you a story. So Rod Blagojevich was the governor of Illinois. He was the 40th governor. He's the only one who was ever impeached, and he went to prison for corruption, particularly for trying to sell to the highest bidder his ability as governor to fill a U.S. Senate seat that was left open by Barack Obama becoming president. Blagojevich wrote in an article in the Wall Street Journal from prison saying that it wasn't really his fault. He wrote, quote, "Here I am in my sixth year of a 14-year prison sentence for the routine practice of attempting to raise campaign funds," end of the quote. He had faced two separate trials and was convicted on 18 different criminal counts on things like extortion and conspiracy and lying to the FBI. He tried to get the CEO of a children's hospital to give his campaign $25,000 if the state would increase the amount they would reimburse pediatric specialists. He tried using the Senate appointment to either get campaign cash or a better job for himself, and he was convicted based on wiretapping, so essentially he was caught in the act of doing the crimes. But the headline in the Wall Street Journal article was, quote, "I'm in prison for practicing politics," end quote. And this is an example of what we call an appeal to misery. It has a fancy Latin name of the argument ad misericordium, but you also might more commonly know it as a sob story. Today we're going to dive into this common persuasion tactic. Newsmakers use these emotional appeals to make us feel sympathy and compassion. It involves persuading others by making them feel sorry for someone, and this tactic works because it taps into our natural empathy, making us more likely to support a cause or a person. So let's walk through a couple of real-world examples. Have a listen.
Look at the way I've been treated lately, especially by the media. No politician in history, and I say this with great surety, has been treated worse or more unfairly.
That was the once and future president back in his first term speaking at the Coast Guard Academy graduation. His claim that he was treated worse than any president is, well, doubtful. But notice how this appeal to pity could also serve him. If the media runs negative stories about things you've done, he should get a pass, the logic goes, because the media is just being mean to him. And that's a way politicians can use an appeal to pity. They don't always use it negatively, though. Have a listen to these clips of Michelle Obama talking about her husband.
And as I got to know Barack, I realized that even though he had grown up all the way across the country, he'd been brought up just like me. Barack was raised by a single mom who struggled to pay the bills and by grandparents who stepped in when she needed help. Barack's grandmother started out as a secretary at a community bank, and she moved quickly up the ranks, but like so many women, she hit a glass ceiling. And for years, men no more qualified than she was, men she had actually trained, were promoted up the ladder ahead of her, earning more and more money while Barack's family continued to scrape by. But day after day, she kept on waking up at dawn to catch the bus, arriving at work before anyone else, giving her best without complaint or regret. And she would often tell Barack, "So long as you kids do well, Bear, that's all that really matters." Like so many American families, our families weren't asking for much.
Now, many, many American politicians run with statements like this, referring to their humble upbringing or their hardworking parents who gave them a chance. This positive appeal to pity, "Look how far I've come," is intended to build empathy. But it also serves to obscure the fact that many candidates for national-level offices in the United States are very wealthy. By highlighting humble beginnings, politicians build rapport and trust with working-class voters, making them more likely to be supported by them. It doesn't always work, though. Appeals to pity can sometimes backfire or be seen as manipulative. You know, critics may point out hypocrisy or highlight consequences of actions that are actually real. So, for example, a criminal might argue that their difficult background justifies their actions. You know, for example, "I had to feed my family, so I stole." But the critic might point out that the person that they stole from has still suffered a loss. So, in summary, while appeals to pity can be a powerful tool in persuasion, they have to be used carefully and ethically to avoid appearing manipulative. When I come back, we're going to look at a common political strategy that is probably affecting both the news that you see and what you think about it. I'll be right back. Welcome back. You've probably been hearing lately that the world is a pretty divided place. People have ferocious disagreements over things like human rights, immigration, abortion, and more. So how did we get this way? One thing that has contributed is what political scientists call wedge issues. These are tricky political topics that are designed to drive people apart instead of bringing them together. So imagine that you're at a family gathering. Perhaps you were at one for the holidays this year, and someone brought up legalizing drugs or including trans women in women's sports, and the topic immediately makes half the table tense up. That is basically what a wedge issue does, but on a much bigger scale. These are topics that create instant lines in the sand. You're either totally for something or you're totally against it. You know, you can take something like abortion or gun control. These aren't just casual conversations. They're issues where people have deep personal beliefs, and politicians know this, and they use these topics strategically. Their goal isn't always to change your mind, but it is to get you fired up and motivated to vote. And here's an interesting twist. A lot of times, these issues aren't even brand new. They're existing topics that suddenly get spotlighted, you know, kind of like poking a bruise to make someone react. And so, really smart or sneaky part is how politicians target voters who aren't completely comfortable with their current party. You know, maybe you mostly agree with one side, but this one issue makes you hesitate. That is exactly the voter a wedge issue is meant to influence, and it's very deliberate. Political strategists are constantly scanning the landscape looking for topics that can spark that kind of division, and they're very strategic about how they talk about these issues. They'll use specific words, highlight certain angles, and make sure that the topic feels like you have to pick a side. There's no middle ground. And a fascinating part of it is that they're not always trying to change your mind. Sometimes they just want to activate voters who feel conflicted. Maybe you mostly like one political party, but this one issue makes you uncomfortable. You're their target. The media plays a big role too. The more a topic gets discussed, the more important it seems, and external events can turn an issue into a wedge overnight. A massive immigration wave, a controversial court decision, a pandemic-inspired mask mandate. Suddenly, what was background noise becomes front-page news. And in two-party systems, the opposition is always looking to create rifts. In multi-party systems, smaller parties use these issues to expose cracks in the bigger party's foundations. It's like political warfare, but with words instead of weapons. And the goal is to make voters care so deeply about one specific issue that they'll change their entire political alignment. Let's look at some examples. In the 1960s, civil rights became a turning point that fundamentally changed American politics. The Democratic Party faced a critical moment that would reshape the nation's entire political landscape. At the time, the Democrats were a complex coalition of Northern liberals and Southern conservatives, and the push for civil rights legislation created really intense internal conflicts. As the party supported the Civil Rights Act, Southern Democrats who opposed racial immigration found themselves at a crossroads, and Republicans saw an opportunity. They highlighted racial issues so that they could attract Southern Democrats who felt abandoned by their own party. Senator Strom Thurmond was among the first to switch parties, signaling that massive political shift, and it was immediate and profound in its impact because Black voters, who had previously supported Republicans, moved overwhelmingly to the Democratic Party. Southern white voters began moving toward Republicans, creating a really important political realignment. And George Wallace's 1968 presidential campaign epitomized this tension. He was running as a third-party candidate on a segregationist platform, and he won 46 electoral votes from the Deep South. So, you know, this wasn't just about changing individual minds. It was about mobilizing voters and creating political boundaries. The civil rights issue forced politicians to take definitive stands. And so what had become unspoken tensions then became public conversations. Here's another example. In modern politics, immigration has become a complex and really powerful tool for creating political divisions. It's multidimensional, right? It touches on economics and labor and welfare and national identity and ethnicity. And so it's a really effective wedge issue. During Ronald Reagan's era, the Republican coalition first saw immigration's potential to be divisive. So pro-business Republicans saw immigrants as essential cheap labor, while social conservatives viewed them as a threat to traditional culture. And this was an internal tension that really created a fundamental difference within their party. Political parties have really shifted their positions over time. So Democrats initially tried to limit immigration to protect worker wages and later reframed the issue through a civil rights lens. Republicans changed immigration from an economic discussion to a national security and cultural identity debate. And the strategic use of immigration goes beyond just talking about policy, because politicians will target what they call cross-pressured voters. These are party members who disagree with their party's stance on a critical issue. And by raising immigration's political importance, they forced voters to confront sort of internal conflicts that they had over ideology. Mainstream parties respond to this pressure in two ways. They either accommodate anti-immigrant positions or they try to dismiss the issue entirely. And both strategies are pretty risky. Accommodating anti-immigrant rhetoric can really alienate moderate voters, but ignoring the issue can push voters towards more extreme views. And there's plenty of international examples too. So in the 2017 German election, the anti-immigrant AfD party gained a lot of support by emphasizing refugee influx, and the Netherlands has seen challenger parties successfully exploit immigration to create divisions in their established political groups as well. So let's have one more example. In the 2020 U.S. presidential election, COVID-19 was a powerful political tool that divided voters and really affected campaign strategies. So Donald Trump and Joe Biden used the pandemic to create stark, really political differences and also to mobilize their base. On Trump's side, he emphasized economic recovery, arguing that businesses needed to remain open. He promised a vaccine before Election Day and claimed that Biden would shut down the economy. Biden countered by stating that economic recovery depended on controlling the pandemic, and this issue really divided people. You saw voters who switched their parties based on pandemic responses. Both of the campaigns targeted those cross-pressured voters, those who typically support a party but disagree with its pandemic approach. And media coverage from March to June in 2020 really ensured that COVID-19 was a central election topic. There was constant reporting, and it made the pandemic impossible to ignore, and it transformed it from a health crisis into a political battleground. So Biden was framing the pandemic as a public health issue, highlighting how the virus disproportionately affected Black and Latino communities, and this helped him gain support among minority voters. Trump, on the other hand, focused on economic impacts, and he argued that lockdowns were more dangerous than the virus was. And voter groups responded differently. White voters were more likely to support Trump's economic arguments. Black and Latino voters gravitated toward Biden's public health approach. And the pandemic, I think, is a good example of a wedge. It created strong polarization. It got a lot of media coverage, and it triggered really, really intense voter reactions. You could see the issue's emotional power in the protests against lockdowns and mask mandates. And these strategies led to record voter turnout. The 2020 election saw more Americans vote than in any previous election, and COVID played a really big role in motivating those voters. So in that sense, the pandemic was more than a health crisis. It became a lens through which voters understood leadership and government responsibility and national priorities. And both candidates used it to draw really clear lines about their visions for America. It had another effect, though. The COVID-19 debate did more than just divide voters. It damaged trust in medical science. Politicians turned health guidance into a political fight, making people view medical advice as a choice between political sides. And ultimately, this meant that people stopped listening to doctors and scientists. Instead of seeing medical advice as helpful information, they saw it as an attack from another political party, and people began choosing political loyalty over personal health. And you saw that areas with more political fighting had worse COVID-19 outcomes. People who rejected medical advice because of political beliefs were less likely to get vaccines or follow safety guidelines, and this meant that more people got sick and died. And the damage went beyond just COVID itself, because people learned to distrust medical experts entirely. And in future health emergencies, it's likely that people are going to ignore important health warnings because they see them as political statements. You can kind of see this already when the governor of California declared a state of emergency to get funding to help fight bird flu in cows. "I will not comply" and "do not comply" became trending topics on Twitter. People saying, "No, you're not going to get a mask back on me," kind of thing. So by turning health into a political weapon, politicians have created a dangerous situation. They taught people to question medical science based on political belief and not on facts. And so future health crises could be more deadly. And now micro-targeting has revolutionized this approach. You can imagine a campaign sending a text message about gun rights to a rural voter in Texas that looks completely different from an email sent to a suburban mom in Michigan on the same topic. With data analytics, they can customize messages down to individual voters and their preferences. And in the 2020 election, Trump and Biden used this technique extensively with COVID messaging. Language is everything. Candidates use what political strategists call code words, specific phrases that are designed to trigger those emotional responses. When Joe Biden framed COVID as a public health crisis and Trump downplayed the virus, they weren't just describing events, they were creating entire frameworks for how to think about the pandemic. Negative advertising was a core weapon, too. So instead of just promoting their own position, campaigns spent enormous energy telling voters how catastrophic the opposing side's stance would be. Every issue becomes an immediate life or death crisis. Immigration, gun control, minimum wage, these aren't just policy discussions. They're portrayed as existential threats that demand action. Third-party endorsements add another layer of credibility. So a union leader supporting a minimum wage increase or a respected medical professional discussing the pandemic, pulling in these kinds of voices helps to legitimize the framing of the wedge issue. And then the media landscape amplifies everything. There's strategic press releases, there's well-timed leaks, orchestrated public appearances. Campaigns are constantly trying to dominate the narrative. What's brilliant and sometimes cynical is that success isn't always about changing minds. Sometimes the goal is just to create so much noise around an issue that it drowns out other conversations. By making one topic seem like the most critical thing in the world, they control voter attention. So, social media isn't just a communication tool, it's a political battlefield. In 2020, campaigns could send a voter in Wisconsin a completely different message about COVID than a voter in Florida. A suburban mother might get a message about family safety, while a rural worker gets a message about economic recovery. These aren't just different messages, they're kind of precision-guided political weapons. And then algorithms are a real game changer. Platforms like Facebook and X are designed to keep you engaged, and nothing keeps people more engaged than controversy. An inflammatory post about immigration or vaccine mandates will spread several times faster than a nuanced policy explanation. And the algorithm doesn't care about truth, it cares about engagement. So we get these echo chambers, and disinformation spreads really fast. During the 2020 election, claims of electoral fraud weren't just rumors, they were algorithmic tsunamis. A single misleading tweet could reach millions in hours, and it created entire parallel narratives about the election. It's not all dark. Social media can also be a democratizing force, and minority voices that would have never been heard in traditional media can now shape those conversations. A local activist can challenge a national narrative with a viral tweet. And fundraising has been revolutionized too. A wedge issue that resonates can generate millions in small donations within hours. Politicians know how to push emotional buttons to open those wallets. The risk is pretty big, though. You know, if voters perceive a wedge issue strategy as manipulative, it can be instantaneous backlash. You know, one tone-deaf post can destroy months of carefully crafted messaging. I think you see this a little bit right now with the discussions over the H-1B worker visas in the U.S. Platforms are trying to fight back sometimes with fact-checking and counter-narratives, but it's trying to stop a flood with a garden hose. So, for you as a media consumer, how can you tell when an issue is being used to be divisive? Politicians follow a specific playbook to create wedge issues. First, they choose a controversial topic. If it's gun rights or abortion, those are perfect wedge issues. Their goal is to pick a subject that really makes people feel strongly. And then they simplify the issue. Really complex problems get reduced to simple statements. You're either with us or you're against us, and there's no room for compromise. And then they use strategic communication. They flood the media with their message. They use those code words that trigger emotional responses. So a politician will talk about protecting our borders when really what they're trying to do is make you afraid of immigrants. They're trying for those cross-pressured voters. And timing matters. Wedge issues often show up when a party is losing support. You can pay attention to this if you're in the United States when we start talking about immigration, for example. Immigration usually becomes a topic of conversation when political parties are not doing very well with some things they've done. They're a distraction, you know, a way to shift attention from other problems. The real goal isn't just to change minds, it's to mobilize voters who aren't strongly committed, because if they can make you feel angry or scared, you're more likely to vote. There's a real cost as well. When a wedge issue becomes starkly either or, you know, that kind of false choice, it tends to discourage people from discussing issues, and that often can't even tell that they mostly agree with other people. Let's go back to our example of immigration. In the U.S., immigration is a matter of national policy, right? It's set at the federal level. But I'm going to guess that most of us listening could agree that when it comes to migrants crossing the southern border, and not all immigration is that, but some of it is, there are some states that are going to be more affected than others because they touch that border. We could agree on that, but we don't often talk about that. Instead, what we see is politicians from remote places in the country making these very media splashy, grandstanding visits to the border. And it starts looking like it's a battle of just two views, right? A view that immigrants are good for the country and the view that immigrants are bad for the country. And we've lost our ability to have conversations about what actually happens to people when they enter the U.S. Again, there's probably a lot we could agree on, but because of these wedge strategies, we don't always talk about it. Wedge issues don't solve problems. They create conflict, and they turn neighbors into enemies. They make compromise seem impossible. So understanding how wedge issues work is the first step in you resisting their power. When you recognize these strategies, you can make more informed choices and see beyond the political manipulation. Thanks for getting Unspun with me this week. Unspun is a production of me, Amanda Sturgill, and is a proud member of the MSW Media family of podcasts. Send me your thoughts and ideas about trickery in the news on Gmail at theunspunpodcast@gmail.com. I even write back. And find this episode's show notes and more information at theunspunpodcast.substack.com. Want to learn more and get smarter? Check out my book, Detecting Deception, Tools to Fight Fake News, which is available on Amazon or your favorite online bookseller. And until next time, stay sharp, everyone.
I'm Frances Callier.
And I'm Angela V. Shelton.
And we're Frangela.
You know what you need in your life? The Final Word podcast.
Yes, you do.
That's right. It is the final word on all things political and pop cultural.
Where we make real news real funny.
Where we inspire you so you can hashtag resist.
Subscribe and get a new episode of the Final Word podcast each week. It's the news we think you need to hear.
That's right. We think you need to hear it. Okay.
Yeah, it's what we say so.
That's right. And because all we do is give, every Thursday you can listen to our hysterical podcast, Idiot of the Week.
We round up the stupid because you know what? Somebody has to.
Okay. All we do is give.